Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back, everyone, to Agatha Christie's The Mystery of the Blue Train, a Poirot mystery. This is your host, John Hagedorn. This is 1001 Stories for the Road. Today, chapters 27 and 28. And now, chapter 27 of The Mystery of the Blue Train, Interview with Morel. When Knighton left Catherine, he went in search of Hercule Poirot, whom he found in the rooms, jauntily placing the minimum stake on the even numbers. As Knighton joined him, the number 33 turned up, and Poirot's stake was swept away. "Bad luck," said Knighton. "Are you going to stake again?" Poirot shook his head.
"Not at present."
"Do you feel the fascination of gambling?" asked Knighton curiously.
"Not at roulette."
Knighton shot a swift glance at him. His own face became troubled. He spoke haltingly, with a touch of deference.
I wonder if you're busy, Monsieur Poirot. There is something I would like to ask you about."
"I am at your disposal. Shall we go outside? It is pleasant in the sunshine."
They strolled out together, and Knighton drew a deep breath.
"I love the Riviera," he said.
"I came here first 12 years ago, during the war, when I was sent to Lady Templin's hospital. It was like paradise, coming from Flanders to this."
"It must have been," said Poirot.
"How long ago the war seems now," mused Knighton.
They walked on in silence for some little way.
"You have something on your mind?" said Poirot.
Knighton looked at him in some surprise.
"You are quite right," he confessed. "I don't know how you knew it, though."
"It showed itself only too plainly," said Poirot, dryly.
"I did not know that I was so transparent."
"It is my business to observe the physiognomy,"
the little man explained, with dignity.
"I will tell you, Monsieur Poirot. You have heard of this dancer woman, Morel?"
"She who is the chérie amie of Mr. Derek Catherine?"
"Yes, that is the one. And, knowing this, you will understand that Mr. Van Alden is naturally prejudiced against her. She wrote to him, asking for an interview. He told me to dictate a curt refusal, which of course I did. This morning she came to the hotel and sent up her card, saying that it was urgent and vital that she should see Mr. Van Alden at once."
"You interested me," said Poirot.
"Mr. Van Alden was furious. He told me what message to send down to her. I ventured to disagree with him. It seemed to me both likely and probable that this woman, Morel, might give us valuable information. We know that she was on the blue train, and she may have seen or heard something that it might be vital for us to know. Don't you agree with me, Monsieur Poirot?"
"I do," said Poirot, dryly. "Mr. Van Alden, if I may say so, behaved exceedingly foolishly."
"I'm glad you take that view of the matter," said the secretary. "Now I'm going to tell you something, Monsieur Poirot. So strongly did I feel the unwisdom of Mr. Van Alden's attitude that I went down privately and had an interview with the lady."
"Eh bien?"
"The difficulty was that she insisted on seeing Mr. Van Alden himself. I softened his message as much as I possibly could. In fact, to be candid, I gave it in a very different form. I said that Mr. Van Alden was too busy to see her at present, but that she might make any communication she wished to me. That, however, she could not bring herself to do, and she left without saying anything further. But I have a strong impression, Monsieur Poirot, that that woman knows something."
"This is serious," said Poirot quietly. "You know where she is staying?"
"Yes. Knight mentioned the name of the hotel."
"Good," said Poirot. "We will go there immediately."
The secretary looked doubtful.
"And Mr. Van Alden?"
"And Mr. Van Alden?"
he queried doubtfully.
"Mr. Van Alden is an obstinate man," said Poirot dryly. "I do not argue with obstinate men. I act in spite of them. We will go and see the lady immediately. I will tell her that you are empowered by Mr. Van Alden to act for him, and that you have guarded yourself well from contradicting me."
Knighton still looked slightly doubtful, but Poirot took no notice of his hesitation. At the hotel, they were told that Mademoiselle was in, and Poirot sent up both his and Knighton's cards, with "From Mr. Van Alden" penciled upon them. Word came down that Mademoiselle Morel would receive them. When they were ushered into the dancers' apartments, Poirot immediately took the lead.
"Mademoiselle," he murmured, bowing very low, "we are here on behalf of Mr. Van Alden."
"Ah, and why did he not come himself?"
"He is indisposed," said Poirot mendaciously. "The Riviera throat, it has him in its grip, but me, I am empowered to act for him, as is Major Knighton, his secretary, unless, of course, Mademoiselle would prefer to wait a fortnight or so."
If there was one thing of which Poirot was tolerably certain, it was that to a temperament such as Morel's, the mere word "wait" was anathema.
"Eh bien, I will speak, messieurs," she cried. "I have been patient. I have held my hand. And for what? That I should be insulted? Yes, insulted. Ah, does he think to treat Morel like that? To throw her off like an old glove? I tell you, never has a man tired of me. Always it is I who tire of them."
She paced up and down the room, her slender body trembling with rage. A small table impeded her free passage, and she flung it from her into a corner, where it splintered against a wall.
"That is what I will do to him," she cried. "And that!"
Picking up a glass bowl filled with lilies, she flung it into the grate, where it smashed into 100 pieces. Knighton was looking at her with cold, British disapproval. He felt embarrassed and ill at ease. Poirot, on the other hand, with twinkling eyes, was thoroughly enjoying the scene.
"Ah, it is magnificent," he cried. "It can be seen. Madame has a temperament."
"I am an artiste," said Morel. "Every artiste has a temperament. I told Derrick to beware, and he would not listen."
She whirled round on Poirot suddenly.
"It is true, is it not, that he wants to marry that English miss?"
Poirot coughed.
"I have heard," he murmured, "that he adores her passionately."
Morel came towards them.
"He murdered his wife," she screamed. "There, now you have it. He told me beforehand that he meant to do it. He had got to an impasse. Zut! He took the easiest way out."
You said that Mr. Catherine murdered his wife?"
"Yes, yes, yes. Have I not told you so?"
"The police," murmured Poirot, "will need proof of that, statement."
"I tell you, I saw him come out of her compartment that night on the train."
"When?" asked Poirot sharply.
"Just before the train reached Lyon."
"You'll swear to that, mademoiselle?"
It was a different Poirot who spoke now, sharp and decisive.
"Yes."
There was a moment's silence. Morel was panting, and her eyes, half defiant, half frightened, went from the face of one man to the other.
"This is a serious matter, mademoiselle," said the detective. "You realize how serious?"
"Certainly I do."
"That is well," said Poirot. "Then you understand, mademoiselle, that no time must be lost. You will, perhaps,
accompany us now to the office of the examining magistrate."
Morel was taken aback. She hesitated, but, as Poirot had foreseen, she had no loophole for escape.
"Very well," she muttered. "I will fetch a coat."
Left alone together, Poirot and Knighton exchanged glances.
"It is necessary to act while, the iron is hot," murmured Poirot. "She is temperamental. In an hour's time, maybe, she will repent, and she will wish to draw back. We must prevent that at all costs."
Morel reappeared, wrapped in a sand-colored velvet wrap trimmed with leopard skin. She looked not altogether like a leopardess, tawny and dangerous. Her eyes still flashed with anger and determination. They found Monsieur Caw and the examining magistrate together. A few brief introductory words from Poirot, and Mademoiselle Morel was courteously entreated to tell her tale. This she did in much the same words as she had done to Knighton and Poirot, though with far more soberness of manner.
"This is an extraordinary story, Mademoiselle," said Monsieur Carrège slowly. He leant back in his chair, adjusted his pince-nez, and looked keenly and searchingly at the dancer through them. "You wish us to believe Monsieur Catherine actually boasted of the crime to you beforehand?"
"Yes, yes. She was too healthy," he said. "If she were to die, it must be an accident. He would arrange it all."
"You are aware, mademoiselle," said Monsieur Carrège sternly, "that you are making yourself out to be an accessory before the fact?"
"Me? But not the least in the world, monsieur. Not for a moment did I take that statement seriously. Ah, no, indeed. I know men, monsieur. They say many wild things. It would be an odd state of affairs if one were to take all they said en pied de la lettre."
The examining magistrate raised his eyebrows.
"We are to take it, then, that you regarded Mr. Kettering's threats as mere idle words? May I ask, mademoiselle, what made you throw up your engagements in London and come out to the Riviera?"
Morel looked at him with melting black eyes.
"I wished to be with the man I loved," she said simply. "Was it so unnatural?"
Poirot interpolated a question gently.
"Was it, then, at Mr. Catherine's wish that you accompanied him to Nice?"
Morel seemed to find a little difficulty in answering this. She hesitated perceptibly before she spoke. When she did, it was with a haughty indifference of manner.
"In such matters I please myself, monsieur," she said.
That the answer was not an answer at all was noted by all three men. They said nothing. "When were you first convinced that Mr. Kettering had murdered his wife?"
"As I tell you, monsieur, I saw Mr. Kettering come out of his wife's compartment just before the train due into Lyon. There was a look on his face. Ah, at the moment, I could not understand it. A look haunted and terrible. I shall never forget it."
Her voice rose shrilly, and she flung out her arms in an extravagant gesture.
"Quite so," said Monsieur Carrège.
"Afterwards, when I found that Madame Kettering was dead when the train left Lyon, then I knew."
"And still, you did not go to the police, mademoiselle," said the commissary, mildly. Morel glanced at him superbly. She was clearly enjoying herself in the role she was playing.
"I could not betray my lover. Should I have betrayed my lover?"
she asked.
"Ah, no. Do not ask a woman to do that."
"Yet now," hinted Monsieur Caw.
"Now it is different. He has betrayed me. Shall I suffer that in silence?"
The examining magistrate checked her.
"Quite so, quite so,"
he murmured soothingly.
"And now, mademoiselle, perhaps you will read over the statement of what you have told us, see that it is correct, and sign it."
Morel wasted no time on the document.
"Yes," she said, "it is correct."
She rose to her feet.
"You require me no longer, messieurs."
"At present, no, mademoiselle."
"And Derrick will be arrested?"
"At once, mademoiselle. Morel laughed cruelly and drew her fur draperies closer about her.
He should have thought of this before he insulted me, she cried.
There is one little matter.
Poirot coughed apologetically.
Just a matter of detail.
Yes.
What makes you think Madame Catherine was dead when the train left Lyon?
Morel stared.
But she was dead.
Was she?
Yes, of course.
She came to an abrupt stop. Poirot was regarding her intently, and he saw the wary look that came into her eyes.
I have been told so. Everybody says so.
Oh, said Poirot.
I was not aware that the fact had been mentioned outside the examining magistrate's office.
Morel appeared somewhat discomposed.
One hears these things, she said vaguely. They get about. Somebody told me. I can't remember who it was.
She moved to the door. Monsieur Caw sprang forward to open it for her, and as he did so, Poirot's voice rose gently once more.
And the jewels? Pardon, mademoiselle. Can you tell me anything about those?
The jewels? What jewels?
The rubies of Catherine the Great. Since you hear so much, you must have heard of them.
I know nothing about any jewels, said Morel sharply.
She went out, closing the door behind her. Monsieur Caw came back to his chair. The examining magistrate sighed.
What a fury, he said. But diable, monsieur, I wonder if she's telling the truth. I think she is.
There is some truth in her story, certainly, said Poirot. We have confirmation of it from Miss Gray. She was looking down the corridor a short time before the train reached Lyon, and she saw Monsieur Catherine go into his wife's compartment.
The case against him seems quite clear, said the commissary, sighing.
It is a thousand pities, he murmured.
How do you mean? Asked Poirot.
It has been the ambition of my life to lay the Comte de la Roche by the heels. This time, ma foi, I thought we had got him. This other, it is not nearly so satisfactory.
Monsieur Carrez rubbed his nose.
If anything goes wrong, he observed cautiously, it will be most awkward.
Mr. Kettering is of the aristocracy. It will get into the newspapers. If we have made a mistake. He shrugged his shoulders forebodingly.
The jewels now, said the commissary. What do you think he's done with them?
He took them for a plant, of course, said Monsieur Carrez. They must have been a great inconvenience to him and very awkward to dispose of.
Poirot smiled.
I have an idea of my own about the jewels. Tell me, messieurs, what do you know of a man called the Marquis?
The commissary leaned forward excitingly.
The Marquis? He said. The Marquis. Do you think he's mixed up in this affair, Monsieur Poirot?
I just ask you what you know of him.
The commissary made an expressive grimace.
Not as much as we'd like to,
he observed ruefully. He works behind the scenes, you understand. He has underlings who do his dirty work for him. But he is someone high up. That we are sure of. He does not come from the criminal classes.
A Frenchman?
Yes, at least we believe so. But we're not sure. He has worked in France, in England, even in America. There was a series of robberies in Switzerland last autumn, which were laid at his door. By all accounts, he's a grand seigneur, speaking French and English with equal perfection, and his origin is a mystery.
Poirot nodded and rose to take his departure.
Can you tell us nothing more, Monsieur Poirot? Urged the commissary.
At present, no, said Poirot, but I may have news awaiting me at my hotel.
Monsieur Carrez looked uncomfortable.
If the Marquis is concerned in this, he began, and then stopped.
It upsets our ideas, complained Monsieur Caw.
"It does not upset mine," said Poirot. "On the contrary, I think it agrees with them very well. Au revoir, messieurs. If news of any importance comes to me, I will communicate it to you immediately."
He walked back to his hotel with a grave face. In his absence, a telegram had come to him. Taking a paper cutter from his pocket, he slid it open. It was a long telegram, and he read it over twice before slowly putting it in his pocket. Upstairs, Georges was awaiting his master.
"I am fatigued, Georges, much fatigued. Will you order for me a small pot of chocolate?"
The chocolate was duly ordered and brought, and Georges set it at the little table at his master's elbow. As he was preparing to retire, Poirot spoke.
"I believe, Georges, that you have a good knowledge of the English aristocracy," murmured Poirot.
Georges smiled apologetically.
"I think that I might say that I have, sir," he replied.
"I suppose that it is your opinion, Georges, that criminals are invariably drawn from the lower orders."
"Not always, sir. There was a great trouble with one of the Duke of Devizes' younger sons. He left Eton under a cloud, and after that he caused great anxiety on several occasions. The police would not accept the view that it was kleptomania. A very clever young gentleman, sir, but vicious through and through, if you take my meaning. His grace shipped him to Australia, and I hear he was convicted out there under another name. Very odd, sir, but there it is. The young gentleman, I need hardly say, was not in want financially."
Poirot nodded his head slowly.
"Love of excitement," he murmured, "and a little kink in the brain somewhere. I wonder now."
He drew out the telegram from his pocket and read it again.
"Then there was the Lady Mary Fox's daughter," continued the valet in a mood of reminiscence. "Swindled tradespeople. Something shocking she did. Very worrying to the best families, if I may say so. And there are many other queer cases I could mention."
"You have a wide experience, Georges," murmured Poirot. "I often wonder, have you lived so exclusively with titled families, that you demean yourself by coming as a valet to me. I put it down to love of excitement on your part."
"Not exactly, sir," said George. "I happened to see in society snippets that you had been received at Buckingham Palace. That was just when I was looking for a new situation. His Majesty, so it said, had been most gracious and friendly, and thought very highly of your abilities."
"Ah," said Poirot. "One always likes to know the reason for things."
He remained in thought for a few moments, and then said,
"You rang up Mademoiselle Papabolas?"
"Yes, sir. She and her father will be pleased to dine with you tonight."
"Ah," said Poirot thoughtfully.
He drank off his chocolate, set the cup and saucer neatly in the middle of the tray, and spoke gently, more to himself than to the valet.
"The squirrel, my good Georges, collect the nuts. He stores them up in the autumn, so that they may be of advantage to him later. To make a success of humanity, Georges, we must profit by the lessons of those below us in the animal kingdom. I have always done so. I have been the cat, watching at the mouse hole. I have been the good dog, following upon the scent, and not taking my nose from the trail. And also, my good Georges, I have been the squirrel. I have stored away the little fact here, a little fact there. I go now to my store, and I take out one particular nut, a nut that I stored away. Let me see. 17 years ago it was. You follow me, Georges?"
"I should hardly have thought, sir," said George, "that nuts would have kept so long as that, though I know one can do wonders with preserving bottles."
Poirot looked at him and smiled. We'll return with Chapter 28 right after these sponsor messages.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
And now, Chapter 28, Poirot Plays the Squirrel. Poirot started to keep his dinner appointment with a margin of 3/4 of an hour to spare. He had an object in this. The car took him, not straight to Monte Carlo, but to Lady Templin's house at Cap Martin, where he asked for Miss Gray. The ladies were dressing, and Poirot was shown into a small salon to wait. And here, after a lapse of 3 or 4 minutes, Lennox Templin came to him. "Catherine's not quite ready yet," she said. "Can I give her a message, or would you rather wait until she comes down?" Poirot looked at her thoughtfully. He was a minute or two in replying, as though something of great weight hung upon his decision. Apparently the answer to such a simple question mattered.
"No," he said at last. "No, I do not think it is necessary that I should wait to see Mademoiselle Catherine. I think, perhaps, that it is better that I should not. These things are sometimes difficult."
Lennox waited politely, her eyebrows slightly raised.
"I have a piece of news," continued Poirot. "You will, perhaps, tell your friend? Mr. Catherine was arrested tonight for the murder of his wife."
"You want me to tell Catherine that?" asked Lennox. She breathed rather hard, as though she had been running. Her face, Poirot thought, looked white and strained, rather noticeably so.
"Yes, if you please, mademoiselle."
"Why?" said Lennox. "Do you think Catherine would be upset? Do you think she cares?"
"I don't know, mademoiselle," said Poirot. "See, I admit it, frankly. As a rule, I know everything, but in this case, I do not. You, perhaps, know better than I do."
"Yes," said Lennox, "I know. But I am not going to tell you all the same." She paused for a minute or two, her dark brows drawn together in a frown.
"You believe he did it?"
she said abruptly. Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
"The police say so."
"Ah," said Lennox, "hedging, are you? So there is something to hedge about." Again she was silent, frowning. Poirot said gently,
"You had known Derek Catherine a long time, have you not?"
"Off and on, ever since I was a kid," said Lennox, gruffly. Poirot nodded his head several times without speaking. With one of her brusque movements, Lennox drew forward a chair and sat down on it, her elbows on the table and her face supported by her hands. Sitting thus, she looked directly across the table at Poirot. "What have they got to go on?" she demanded. "Motive, I suppose. Probably came into money at her death."
"He came into 2 million.
"And if she had not died, would he have been ruined?"
"Yes."
"But there must have been more than that.
persisted Lennox. He traveled by the same train, I know, but that would not be enough to go on by itself.
A cigarette case with the letter K on it, which did not belong to Mrs. Kettering, was found in her carriage. And he was seen by two people entering and leaving the compartment just before the train got into Lyon.
What two people?
Your friend, Miss Gray, was one of them. The other was Mademoiselle Morel, the dancer.
And he, Derek, what has he got to say about it?
Demanded Lennox sharply. He denies having entered his wife's compartment at all,
said Poirot.
The fool, said Lennox crisply, frowning.
Just before Lyon, you say? Does nobody know when she died?
The doctor's evidence necessarily cannot be very definite, said Poirot. They are inclined to think that the death was unlikely to have occurred after leaving Lyon. And we know this much, that a few moments after leaving Lyon, Mrs. Kettering was dead.
How do you know that?
Poirot was smiling rather oddly to himself. Someone else went into her compartment and found her dead.
And they did not rouse the train?
No.
Why was that?
Doubtless they had their reasons.
Lennox looked at him sharply.
Do you know the reason?
I think so, yes.
Lennox sat still, turning things over in her mind. Poirot watched her in silence. At last she looked up. A soft color had come into her cheeks, and her eyes were shining.
You think someone on the train must have killed her, but that need not be so at all. What is to stop anyone swinging themselves onto the train when it stopped at Lyon? They could go straight to her compartment, strangle her, and take the rubies, and drop off the train again without anyone being the wiser. She may have been actually killed while the train was in Lyon station. Then she would have been alive when Derek went in, and dead when the other person found her.
Poirot leant back in his chair. He drew a deep breath. He looked across at the girl and nodded his head three times. Then he heaved a sigh.
Mademoiselle, he said, what you have said, that is very just, very true. I was struggling in darkness, and you have shown me a light. There was a point that puzzled me, and you have made it plain.
He got up.
And Derek? Said Lennox.
Who knows? Said Poirot, with a shrug of his shoulders. But I will tell you this, mademoiselle. I am not satisfied. No, I, Hercule Poirot, am not yet satisfied. It may be that this very night I shall learn something more. At least, I go to try.
You are meeting someone?
Yes.
Someone who knows something.
Someone who might know something. In these matters, one must leave no stone unturned. Au revoir, mademoiselle.
Lennox accompanied him to the door.
Have I helped?
She asked. Poirot's face softened as he looked up at her standing on the doorstep above him.
Yes, mademoiselle, you have helped. If things are very dark, always remember that.
When the car had driven off, he relapsed into a frowning absorption, but in his eyes was that faint green light which was always the precursor of the triumph to be. He was a few minutes late at the rendezvous, and found that Monsieur Papopoulos and his daughter had arrived before him. His apologies were abject, and he outdid himself in politeness and small attentions. The Greek was looking particularly benign and noble this evening, a sorrowful patriarch of blameless life. Zia was looking handsome and good-humored. The dinner was a pleasant one. Poirot was his best and most sparkling self. He told anecdotes, he made jokes, he paid graceful compliments to Zia Papopoulos, and he told many interesting incidents of his career. The menu was a carefully selected one, and the wine was excellent.
At the close of dinner, Monsieur Papopoulos inquired politely,
"And the tip I gave you? You have had your little flutter on the horse?"
"I am in communication with my bookmaker," replied Poirot. The eyes of the two men met.
"A well-known horse, eh?"
"No," said Poirot. "It is what our friends, the English, call a dark horse."
"Ah," said Monsieur Papopoulos thoughtfully.
"Now we must step across to the casino and have our little plot at the roulette table," cried Poirot gaily. At the casino, the party separated. Poirot devoted himself solely to Zia, while Papopoulos himself drifted away. Poirot was not fortunate, but Zia had a run of good luck, and soon won a few thousand francs. "It should be as well," she observed dryly to Poirot, "if I stopped now." Poirot's eyes twinkled.
"Superb!" he exclaimed. "You are the daughter of your father, Mademoiselle Zia. To know when to stop. Ah, that is the art."
He looked round the rooms.
"I cannot see your father anywhere about," he remarked carelessly. "I will fetch your cloak for you, mademoiselle, and we will go out in the gardens."
He did not, however, go straight to the cloakroom. His sharp eyes had seen but a little while before the departure of Monsieur Papopoulos. He was anxious to know what had become of the wily Greek. He ran him to earth unexpectedly in the big entrance hall. He was standing by one of the pillars, talking to a lady who had just arrived. That lady was Morel. Poirot sidled unostentatiously round the room. He arrived at the other side of the pillar, and unnoticed by the two who were talking together in an animated fashion, or rather, that is to say, the dancer was talking. Papopoulos contributing an occasional monosyllable and a good many expressive gestures.
"I tell you I must have time," the dancer was saying. "If you give me time, I will get the money."
"To wait." The Greek shrugged his shoulders. "It is awkward."
"Only a very little while," pleaded the other. "Ah, but you must. A week, 10 days. That is all I ask. You can be sure of your affair. The money will be forthcoming."
Papopoulos shifted a little and looked round him uneasily, to find Poirot almost at his elbow with a beaming, innocent face.
"Ah, there you are. Monsieur Papopoulos, I have been looking for you. It is permitted that I take Mademoiselle Zia for a little turn in the gardens?"
"Good evening, mademoiselle." He bowed very low to Morel. "A 1,000 pardons, I did not see you immediately." The dancer accepted his greetings rather impatiently. She was clearly annoyed at the interruption of her tete-a-tete. Poirot was quick to take the hint. Papopoulos had already murmured, "Certainly, but certainly," and Poirot withdrew forthwith. He fetched Zia's cloak, and together they strolled out into the gardens. "This is where the suicides take place," said Zia. Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
"So it is said. Men are foolish, are they not, mademoiselle? To eat, to drink, to breathe the good air, it is a very pleasant thing, mademoiselle. One is foolish to leave all that simply because one has no money, or because the heart aches. L'amour, it causes many fatalities, does it not?"
Zia laughed.
"You should not laugh at love, mademoiselle," said Poirot, shaking an energetic forefinger at her. "You who are young and beautiful."
"Hardly that," said Zia. "You forget that I am 33, Monsieur Poirot. I am frank with you, because it is no good being otherwise. As you told my father, it is exactly 17 years since you aided us in Paris that time."
"When I look at you, it seems much less," said Poirot gallantly. "You were then very much as you are now, mademoiselle. A little thinner, a little paler, a little more serious. 16 years old and fresh from your pension. Not quite a petite pensionnaire. Not quite a woman. You were very delicious,
Very charming, Mademoiselle Zia. Others thought so, too, without a doubt.
At 16, said Zia, one is simple and a little fool.
That may be, said Poirot. Yes, that well may be. At 16, one is credulous, is one not? One believes what one is told.
If he saw the quick sideways glance that the girl shot at him, he pretended not to have done so. He continued dreamily,
It was a curious affair, that, altogether. Your father, mademoiselle, has never understood the true inwardness of it.
No?
When he asked me for details, for explanations, I said to him thus, Without scandal, I have got back for you that which was lost. You must ask no questions.
Do you know, mademoiselle, why I said these things?
I have no idea, said the girl coldly. It was because I had a soft spot in my heart for a little pensionnaire, so pale, so thin, so serious.
I don't understand what you're talking about, cried Zia angrily.
Do you not, mademoiselle? Have you forgotten Antonio Brescia?
He heard the quick intake of her breath, almost a gasp.
He came to work as an assistant in the shop, but not thus could he have got the hold of what he wanted. An assistant can lift his eyes to his master's daughter, can he not? If he is young and handsome, with a glib tongue. And since they cannot make love all the time, they must occasionally talk of things that interest them both, such as that very interesting thing which was temporarily in Monsieur Papopoulos's possession. And since, as you say, mademoiselle, the young are foolish and credulous, it was easy to believe him and to give him a sight of that particular thing, to show him where it was kept. And afterwards, when it is gone, when the unbelievable catastrophe has happened, alas, the poor little pensionnaire, what a terrible position she is in. She is frightened, the poor little one, to speak or not to speak. And then there comes along that excellent fellow, Hercule Poirot. Almost a miracle it must have been, the way things arrange themselves. The priceless heirlooms are restored, and there are no awkward questions.
Zia turned on him fiercely.
You have known all the time? Who told you? Was it Antonio?
Poirot shook his head. No one told me, he said quietly.
I guessed. It was a good guess, was it not, mademoiselle? You see, unless you are good at guessing, it is not much use being a detective.
The girl walked along beside him for some minutes in silence. Then she said, in a hard voice, Well, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to tell my father?
No, said Poirot sharply. Certainly not.
She looked at him curiously.
You want something from me? I want your help, mademoiselle.
What makes you think that I can help you?
I do not think so. I only hope so.
And if I do not help you, then will you tell my father?
But no. Debarrass yourself of that idea, mademoiselle. I am not a blackmailer. I do not hold your secret over your head and threaten you with it.
If I refuse to help you, began the girl slowly,
then you refuse, and that is that.
Then why? She stopped.
Listen, and I will tell you why. Women, mademoiselle, are generous. If they can render a service to one who has rendered a service to them, they will do it. I was generous once to you, mademoiselle. When I might have spoken, I held my tongue.
There was another silence. Then the girl said,
My father gave you a hint the other day.
It was very kind of him.
I do not think, said Zia slowly, that there is anything that I can add to that.
If Poirot was disappointed, he did not show it. Not a muscle of his face changed.
Eh bien, he said cheerfully. Then we must talk of other things.
And he proceeded to chat gaily. The girl was distrait, however, and her answers were mechanical, and not always to the point. It was when they were approaching the casino once more that she seemed to come to a decision.
Monsieur Poirot?
Yes, mademoiselle.
I should like to help you if I could.
You are very amiable, mademoiselle. Very amiable.
Again there was a pause. Poirot did not press her. He was quite content to wait and let her take her own time.
Ah, bah, said Zia. After all, why should I not tell you? My father is cautious, always cautious in everything he says. But I know that with you it is not necessary. You have told us it is only the murderer you seek, and that you are not concerned over the jewels. I believe you. You were quite right when you guessed that we were in Nice because of the rubies. They have been handed over here according to plan. My father has them now. He gave you a hint the other day as to who our mysterious client was.
The Marquis? Murmured Poirot softly.
Yes, the Marquis.
Have you ever seen the Marquis, Mademoiselle Zia?
Once, said the girl, but not very well, she added. It was through a keyhole.
That always presents difficulties, said Poirot sympathetically. But all the same, you saw him.
Would you know him again?
Zia shook her head.
He wore a mask, she explained.
Young or old?
He had white hair. It may have been a wig. It may not have been. It fitted very well. But I do not think he was old. His walk was young, and so was his voice.
His voice? Said Poirot thoughtfully. Ah, his voice. Would you know it again, Mademoiselle Zia?
I might, said the girl.
You were interested in him, eh? It was that took you to the keyhole.
Zia nodded.
Yes, yes, I was curious. One had heard so much. He is not the ordinary thief. He is more like a figure of history or romance.
Yes, said Poirot thoughtfully. Yes, perhaps so.
But it is not this that I meant to tell you, said Zia. It was just one other little fact that I thought might be useful to you.
Yes?
Asked Poirot, encouragingly.
The rubies, as I say, were handed over to my father here at Nice. I did not see the person who handed them over, but...
Yes?
I know one thing. It was a woman.
Thanks for joining us for chapters 27 and 28 from Agatha Christie's The Mystery of the Blue Train. This is your host and storyteller, John Hagedorn, and this is 1001 Stories for the Road. Thanks for joining us for this great, great story. And by the way, I've seen the condensed version on TV, and the condensed version is nothing like the story chapter by chapter, which is much more suspenseful. The one thing the television version did give me was their idea of the characters. Of course, David Suchet played Poirot. And the choice of characters was pretty unique as well. But the story, as it goes chapter by chapter, is a whole lot more interesting, I think, than the television version. Until next week, everyone, stay safe, and we'll be back soon.